Welcome to week 47 of our 4.5 year journey through all of God's inspired word. I hope you have a Bible readily available to you. We are in Joshua chapter number 7 today. We've just finished the amazing story of the taking of Jericho by God's miraculous power. And you remember how the Israelis marched around it one time each day for 6 days, and then finally 7 times, and shouted with the sound of the trumpet, and the walls collapsed so that the Israelis could walk right up into the city proper and deal with any of the survivors of the wall collapse, because probably more than likely the majority of them died with the Lord's collapsing of the walls. Now, the only part of the wall that didn't collapse appears to have been, from archaeological evidence, a portion on the north end. And that's likely to be where Rahab and her family had been waiting for the keeping of the promise of the spies. Now, you remember that the Israelis were told everything was to be left as a sacrifice to God when the city was then burned, except for some of the precious metals which were taken to be used in the tabernacle. And anyone who took anything was going to come under God's judgment. Well, chapter number 7 begins with this preview that the story we're about to read is tied with someone breaking the rule of God about the things in Jericho. Chapter 7, but the people of Israel broke faith in regard to the devoted things. For Achan, the son of Carmi, the son of Zabdi, the son of Zerah, of the tribe of Judah, took some of the devoted things, and the anger of he who is burned against the people of Israel. Now, we cannot say for certain why it is that God decided that other people in Israel needed to be part of the punishment of this choice by this man and his family. We could speculate that maybe some of these other guys were either complicit in it, or they maybe knew about it or had some inkling that it had happened, but for whatever reason, God allows certain Israelis to die because of this choice. So verse 2, Joshua sent men from Jericho to Ai, which is near Beth-Aven, east of Bethel. And he said to them, go up and spy out the land. And the men went up and spied out Ai. Now, I told you that if you've got a decent map, or maybe you can go online and use something like Google Earth, if you check out the terrain, Jericho is bracketed on the north and the south by wadis, wet weather streams, which dig canyons into the topography. And just immediately north of Jericho, this wet weather stream that is coming out of the central highlands of Canaan proper provides access by foot. It's like a trade route up to the top of the ridgeline that goes north and south through central Canaan. At the top of that watershed, at the top of that wadi, is Beth-El, the place where Jacob spent the first night away from home, had the vision of God's angels coming and going between heaven and earth, and this is the ladder of Jacob, and he gives it the name Beth-El, the house of God. And it's the first place that he as an individual set up a monument to God's presence in his life. So Beth-El is a significant Israeli location, and that is where they're headed as they go up from Jericho. Now, before they get to Beth-El, there is a community called I. They're only about 2 or 3 miles apart. And so they need to take the first one that they come to, I, before they can take Beth-El. And the ultimate goal, besides having Bethel under their control, is that this is a crossroads of Canaan. There is a north-south roadway and an east-west roadway. And by taking control of this region between Jericho and Beth-El, they are now in control of the heartland of Canaan proper. All right, so that's the plan, is Joshua is going to send up some people to check it out, and this is what happens. Verse 3, they returned and to Joshua and said to him, do not have all the people go up, but let about 2,000 or 3,000 men go up and attack Ai. Do not make the whole people toil up there, for they are few. So about 3,000 men went up, and from the people. And so we've got a small contingent, because they don't anticipate that this community of Ai is going to give them any trouble, because remember, they're functioning under this idea that with God behind them, one of them can put 10 or more to flight, and 100 of them can cause 1,000 Canaanites to run away. So 3,000 Israelis should be able to take on as many as 30,000 Canaanites, and there's not anywhere like that in the population here at Ai or Bethel together. So they figure, don't make everybody go up this hill. We'll take care of it. Well, they couldn't take care of it because, you see, God was not on their side. And so it was one-to-one sort of fighting. And the Israelis fled before the men of Ai. That's how verse number 4 finishes. And the men of Ai killed about 36 of their men and chased them before the gate as far as Shabarim and struck them at the descent, and the hearts of the people melted and became like water. So what we see described here is that Ai becomes the place where the Israelis are routed for the very first time since they came into the Promised Land. And they get chased the dozen or so miles back down this wadi to the Jericho Plain, and then they go back to Gilgal, the encampment there, with their tails between their legs. 36 Israelis die. And that is not a really high ratio as far as battles go. That's about 1% of the fighting force died in as casualties in this fight. But for the Israelis, who have apparently been winning a lot of the fights, such as Jericho, and such as what happened over against Og and against Sihon, the Amorites, over on the east side of the Jordan, they apparently weren't taking casualties at all. So this shocks them, and they don't understand, why was God not with us? Verse 6, Joshua tore his clothes, so he shows this great grief, and he fell on the earth on his face before the ark of He Who Is until the evening, and he and the elders of Israel, and they put dust on their heads. All these are indicators that this is serious, serious stuff going on. The leadership council is flat on their face, on the ground, ripped clothes, dust being put on their head to show that they are humbled before God, before His ark, not knowing why He has not been on their side. Verse 7, Joshua said, "Alas, oh, my master, He Who Is, why have you brought this people over the Jordan at all to give us into the hands of the Amorites to destroy us? Would that we'd been content to dwell beyond the Jordan." So even Joshua is taken aback by this. He's like, God, why are we even on this side of the Jordan? we had lots of territory that we'd already taken possession of on the east side of the Jordan. Why bring us over here and let us start being beaten, being killed? Verse 8, oh, my master, oh, Lord, what can I say when Israel has turned their backs before their enemies? For the Canaanites and all the inhabitants of the land will hear of it. They will surround us and cut off our name from the earth. And what will you do for your great name? So Joshua now points out to God. This is a prayer technique to talk to God about what he's already said, what he's already told you. So Joshua says, once all the other Canaanites find out that we're beatable, that they can actually kill us, they're going to come in mass and surround us and they'll wipe us out. And then how are your promises to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob going to come true? Your name, O God, will be shamed because you couldn't keep your promises. That's effectively what he is laying before God, expecting that God will do something. He who is said to Joshua. So God engages in some sort of vision at this point and talks to Joshua and tells him, get up. Why have you fallen on your face? Israel has sinned. They have transgressed my covenant that I commanded them. They have taken some of the devoted things. They have stolen and lied and put them among their belongings. Now, the way it's phrased here, it seems as if God thinks Joshua should have already known about this. That Joshua should have been more careful in supervising those who were involved in the battle against Jericho and should have made sure that nobody carried any type of forbidden items out of the city ruins. And that is certainly understandable. Joshua is the leader who was the person that has to answer to God for the behavior of those under his control. So Joshua is now aware that there's the problem that inappropriate confiscation has taken place. Verse 12, therefore, the people of Israel cannot stand before their enemies. They turn their backs before their enemies because they have become devoted for destruction. So this is kind of an ironic phrase that because Israel did not devote everything in Jericho to destruction, because somebody kept some of it for themselves, Israel is going to now be devoted for destruction until they get this problem fixed. Verse number 12 continues, I will be with you no more unless you destroy the devoted things from among you. Get up, consecrate the people and say, consecrate yourselves for tomorrow, for thus says he who is the God of Israel, there are devoted things in your midst, O Israel. You cannot stand before your enemies until you take away the devoted things from among you. In the morning, therefore, you shall be brought near by your tribes, and the tribe that he who is takes by lot shall come near by clans, and the clans that he who is takes shall come near by households, and the household that he who is takes shall come near man by man. And he who is taken with the devoted things shall be burned with fire, which is what happened to Jericho with the things in it that were devoted to destruction. They were burned. He and all that he has, because he has transgressed the covenant of he who is, and because he has done an outrageous thing in Israel. So God lays out the procedure that needs to happen tomorrow. There needs to be a reckoning. And everybody in the Israeli encampment has to be a participant and has to go through the procedure together. This is a learning time for all of them to know that you cannot just ignore God's instructions. Now, the question might be in your mind, well, why didn't God just strike the guy dead that did this? Well, he could have done that. But Israel needed to learn to be responsible for policing itself. You might also ask, well, why didn't God just simply identify the guy to Joshua? Again, this has to be a learning situation where everybody in the community understands that you can't get away with stuff with God. God can pass that information on to the high priest and through the high priest to Joshua, and you would be better off to not do sinful things in the first place, or if you have done it, to fess up. See, confession, as the saying goes, is good for the soul. Acknowledging things that are wrong in your life is the first step in fixing those problems. And the longer you deny the reality, the harder the fix is going to be. And so God is going to allow the Israelites to go through a time of discovering the exact person who did this, and giving that person a chance at each step to actually do the right thing and to step forward. And the way it's going to work, even though it doesn't mention the Urim and the Thummim here, we can be pretty certain that that is the mechanism used here. Remember, the Urim and the Thummim were two stones placed in a special pocket that was right behind the high priest's breastplate. And these stones were used to get a yes or no answer on any question asked by the high priest of God. The stones apparently worked by Jewish tradition by one of the stones glowing. The appropriate answer stone had to glow. Now, there are some commentaries that will talk about, well, one was white, one was black. The high priest would ask the question and then reach in and pull out the colored stone for the answer. Well, that can't be the possible, that can't be the real way it worked, because there is a later story in the time of King Saul where it is reported that the Urim and Thummim were not working. God was not answering by that mechanism. Well, every time that you reach in and you're just using a black and white stone, it's going to work. The answer may not be correct, but it's going to work because the white and black stone are always there. If they were expected to glow, though, and they didn't, that would be a clear indication that they were, that God was not answering. So that's the reason I go with the Jewish tradition that one of the two stones glowed. So what's going to happen is they're going to list out the tribes one name at a time, probably from the top down, and eventually they'll get a yes. Actually, yes for the tribe will be right off the bat. And then they're going to go by larger clan groups within that tribe until they get a specific group. And then there are family, household groups, family groups inside the clans, and they'll go through those names until they get a name. And then they'll bring the individual heads of households forward until the proper one is named, and that person will be the guilty person. All right, so here is how it goes. And you've got a picture then, the use of the Urim and Thummim. This is not like 2 minutes and it's done. This is going to take a while. So Joshua rose early in the morning and brought Israel near tribe by tribe, and the tribe of Judah was taken. So if they go by birth order of the tribes, Judah would be the fourth. If they go by inheritance, Judah is the heir tribe, so it would have been taken first by the Urim and the Thummim answer. Verse 17, he brought near the clans of Judah, and the clan of the Zerahites was taken. And then he brought near the clan of the Zerahites, man by man, and Zabdi was taken. So we're now on the third level down, and this is a small enough group that we now have individual heads of households. And so he brought near his household, man by man, and Achan, the son of Carmi, son of Zabdi, son of Zerah, of the tribe of Judah, was taken. Now think about the fact that through this whole process, Achan, he knows it's him. He knows he's the one that has done something against the rules. He could have stepped forward at any moment and said, I am the man. I am the guilty party. And that would have been better for him. Because by confessing before he gets caught, he shows at least some sort of moral integrity, some sort of recovering of his honor. But if he waits until he is finally identified as the only possible person left, that's not good. Because then it's pretty much by force. Well, anyway, he was taken. So verse number 19, then Joshua said to Achan, my son, give glory to he who is God of Israel. Give praise to him. Now, what's this all about? Giving praise and glory to God. Well, this idea of giving praise, when you see it in the Greek language, it is actually the word for confession. So this is where Joshua is looking the man in the eye and saying, look, just acknowledge what you've done and make things right with God. Get things right with your people. Get things right with your God. Because you know this is not going to end well for you. And so he's trying to fix the man's eternal problem. And so I'm going to throw something out here for you to chew on. Because of the way that he answers, it is possible that even though he is executed, we will meet him someday in glory because he repented enough to get things right before he was executed. And so my hope is that is the case because we always want people to make things right with God for eternity, even if they've screwed things up in this life. And it's one of the reasons I think that the Christian influence in government will often include final opportunities for condemned people to meet with religious figures. Specifically, I'm thinking about Christian religious figures so that they can get right with God before they are executed. All right, verse 20. Achan answered Joshua, truly I have sinned against he who is God of Israel. This is what I did. So he confesses, he acknowledges, even though he waited right down to the end until his name was taken with a yes answer. This is the man. At least he's verbalizing it now and getting it fixed. Verse 21, when I saw among the spoil a beautiful cloak from Shinar, so a Babylonian piece of clothing, very expensive, very pretty, 200 shekels of silver. So shekels in this case is intended to be a weight, but eventually the shekels will be worth a couple of days' wages. So we're talking about, if the estimate is right for later time periods, we're talking about over a year's worth of wages of silver. And then a bar of gold weighing 50 shekels. And again, 50 shekels, think about that as 100. And then take it 10 times that, because gold was usually 10 times more valuable than silver. So we're talking about 1,000 days worth of wages. So what he took was worth years of hard work. So he says, I coveted them and I took them. And see, they are hidden in the earth inside my tent with the silver underneath. And this is the reason why his family is in trouble, by the way. Because he took it home, and with their full knowledge, he digs underneath the little mats that they would have used as the floor for their tents and buries it in the ground and then covers it up. Because he knew what he did was wrong, so he has to hide it. And by doing this, he condemned his family because he made them accessories to his crime. Verse 22. So Joshua sent messengers. They ran to the tent. Behold, it was hidden in his tent with the silver underneath. They took them out of the tent, brought them to Joshua, to all the people of Israel. They laid them down before He Who Is. And Joshua and all Israel with him took Achan, the son of Zerah, and the silver, and the cloak, and the bar of gold, and his sons, and his daughters, and his oxen, and his donkeys, and his sheep, and his tent, and all that he had, and they brought them up to the valley of Achor, the place along that wadi where you leave the plain of Jericho and start on your way up to Ai. So they took him and everything that belongs to him to the scene of the crime, kind of the last place where those people were killed in the retreat. Joshua said, what you did brings trouble on us. And the interesting thing is Achan's word or his name means trouble. They laid them down before the Lord. And Joshua and all the people with him took Achan, the son of Zerah, the silver, the cloak, the bar of gold, his sons, daughters, his oxen, And they brought them up to this Valley of Achor. And I'm afraid we're running out of time. I've been looking at the clock. So let's go ahead and mark our place. We got a bit of a cliffhanger here. And we will pick up the rest of the story of the troubler of Israel the next time we get into God's Word.